From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. For the second day in a row, President Trump scrambled the calculus at the NATO summit in Brussels, declaring that allies behind closed doors had agreed to his demands that they pay even more than they'd previously agreed to for shared defense. French President Emmanuel Macron rejected Trump's account of what took place. At an impromptu news conference afterwards, Trump declared that he believes in NATO, despite reports that in the closed-door meeting he threatened to pull out of the alliance.
There's a great collegial spirit in that room that I don't think they've had in many years. They're very strong. So, very unified, very strong, no problem.
Nina Jankowicz is Global Fellow at the Wilson Center Kennan Institute. She joins us now. Nina, welcome.
Hi, Jeremy. Good to be here.
And what's your takeaway, first of all, from what happened today in Brussels?
Well, I think Trump created a crisis and then declared that he had solved it when in reality nothing has changed. You know, the allies committed to spending 2% of their GDPs on defense at Wales in 2014 after the Russian annexation of Crimea. And defense spending has been on the uptick since then. This really isn't anything to do with Trump.
What do you think Vladimir Putin, you're a Russian scholar, what do you think Vladimir Putin concludes when he sees what's been going on and some of the disarray at the summit?
I think he couldn't have asked for a better outcome unless, you know, all of the allies unilaterally declared Russia no longer a threat. And I'm not sure that's what he wants anyway. For the past more than a decade, since 2005 at the Munich Security Conference, he has been going after the Western structures as we know it, trying to achieve this lack of unity that Trump has just handed him on a platter. And then along with Trump's comments about, you know, not taking the status of the Crimean Peninsula off the table for his upcoming negotiations with Putin, I don't think Putin could ask for more.
What about the pipeline that Trump claims is making Germany a captive of Russia? It is a pipeline that will bring basically natural gas from Russia into Germany. What do you think of that? Does Trump have a point on that?
It's a little bit of a tricky issue. So I think Trump has a very kind of cunningly latched on to this because it is exactly something that the Western countries have been lobbying against for a long time, including Poland and the Baltic states, because it would undermine European energy security, only allowing Europe one route and one supplier, that is Russia, for the entire continent. And it also gives Putin an opportunity to bypass countries like Ukraine and Poland that strongly oppose Russia. It's also a conduit for corruption into Europe. But I don't think Trump is really concerned with any of these things. For him, it's transactional and more about, you know, undermining this unity for NATO and trying to drive home his message to the American people that NATO is not worth their money, which I think, unfortunately, is something that's becoming more and more resonant amongst the public. Although we've seen on Capitol Hill over the past couple of days that that is not something the Congress is willing to agree with.
Do you expect any European leader to really stand up to Trump? Because even in the statements that some people like Macron have made, they're not being as tough with him as he is with them.
Right. And I think even the Secretary General Stoltenberg had an interview with Christiane Amanpour after Trump's press conference today, where he would not acknowledge Trump's continued berating of the allies in order to increase their defense spending to 4%, which is just unheard of and a very silly thing to say. He wouldn't acknowledge that, indeed, the allies have only committed to 2% and nothing has changed after the summit. I think he was unwilling to go after the president in that way. But I think Europe is more and more becoming a bit nervous because they don't know that if they needed the United States, as we have called upon them in the past when we have invoked Article 5, we're the only nation to have done so, that they would not question whether or not we'd come to their aid without Trump first consulting his bogus balance sheet of dues that he believes are owed to NATO, which is absolutely demonstrably false. So I think they're coming up with contingency plans, and this is a really dire moment for the transatlantic alliance when the United States, which has been the de facto leader of NATO for the past 70 years, is turning our back on our allies who have paid in blood to show their commitment to Western values.
Just a few seconds here, but what are you expecting from the Trump-Putin meeting?
I'm very nervous about it, particularly after this press conference today. I think Trump likes to make deals. And the fact, again, that he would not just stick to the United States government's talking points about the status of Crimea is very worrisome to me.
It's Nina Jankowicz, a global fellow at the Wilson Center Kennan Institute. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, now to upstate New York, where the national debate over gun control has reached down to sports teams. In New York's North Country, high schools used to have trap shooting teams, but they lost favor as gun violence became more of an issue. Now the sport's coming back. 16 teams have started up in the region. They're co-ed, members as young as 12. Lauren Rosenthal from North Country Public Radio reports.
I find the Morristown trap shooting team out on their practice fields at a sporting club tucked away on a rural back road in St. Lawrence County. The kids are standing in a row, aiming at clay pigeons careening through the air. Family members watch from the sidelines, and a guy named Jim Bushy ribs his two grandsons from the front row.
If I was him, I'd take the shell and throw at the clay pigeon. He'd probably hit more.
I'm getting a lot better.
All jokes aside, Bushy says he's one of the team's biggest fans. He grew up hunting and fishing around Morristown. And since his grandson signed up for trap shooting, Bushy's gone to almost all their meets.
This is the greatest thing that ever happened for these kids. It teaches them safety, respect.
And it does that, Bushy says, by teaching kids how to handle firearms responsibly. Students here use live ammunition and mostly full-size shotguns.
It's hard to believe, and a lot of people are wondering that. Yeah, we're playing with guns here, but we don't play with guns.
David Young is head coach for Morristown and also a hunter education instructor for the DEC. Number one, he says, is that team members don't pick up a gun unless they pass a special safety course.
Number two is we're going to have fun. And number three, at the end of the day or at the end of the season, we're going to strive for better marksmanship.
In just 2 years, Morristown has grown its trap shooting team from maybe a half dozen members to about 20, which makes sense. Morristown is rural. Hunting and fishing have always been part of the culture here. But for some kids, that culture isn't being passed down. Young says he's meeting students who've never touched a gun before or feel afraid of them.
We have one young lady that started out last year, could barely hit a bird. And this year, she's one of our leaders in our squad.
That young lady is Emma Showers, a painfully shy 14-year-old who loves sports like soccer and softball.
Does this feel like a sport to you in the same way that those do? Or does this feel like kind of a different thing?
It really fits in like the other ones do.
But unlike other sports, Showers and other students are getting a clear message that shooting is different, that it's tied up in a much bigger fight about what role guns should play in our society. This spring, a Manhattan assemblywoman named Linda Rosenthal introduced a bill to ban all marksmanship programs from public schools.
New York State Assemblywoman out of Manhattan has her way. Sports like trap shooting and archery could be taken out of schools with more.
Here is Rosenthal, who's no relation, didn't respond to repeated requests for an interview, but she did talk to a TV station in Syracuse. Rosenthal said she was upset to find out that the teenager who was responsible for the recent shooting in Parkland, Florida, was once on a varsity rifle team.
Nicholas Cruz learned how to be an expert marksman at the very same high school where he killed 17 people.
What's more, that shooting team had gotten funding from one of the nation's most influential lobbying groups, the National Rifle Association. The NRA does help pay for safety classes and marksmanship clubs all across the country. Here in Morristown, that money gets funneled through a local sportsman's club. Rosenthal said all these ties between the NRA, schools, guns, just aren't appropriate.
Having a school offer a program like that is the wrong message.
It's no surprise that sportsmen's groups have pushed back. They say an assemblywoman from New York City doesn't understand how guns are used in rural communities. Even some gun control advocates aren't sure that banning shooting sports from schools is the best move.
I think it's well-intentioned. I just don't think it's thought out well enough.
Paul McQuillan is a coordinator with New Yorkers Against Gun Violence, a group that's pushing for new gun control legislation. I asked McQuillan if it's a problem that shooting programs exist in public schools and that the NRA helps pay for them.
Yeah, I don't see a downside. I mean, the New York State Senate this year voted and passed to allow children as young as 14 to go hunting with an adult, obviously you using guns. So, I mean, if you're going to allow children access to guns, then let's train them and teach them to do it the right way.
And if the NRA wants to fund that training, McQuillan says he applauds it. For now, New York is the only state considering a ban on shooting teams. The bill doesn't have any sponsors in the Senate, and McQuillan says it's not likely to pass. But 14-year-old Emma Showers says she gets it, that bad things are happening, and some people think getting guns and gun education away from schools will somehow make people safer.
They feel like if you take it away, something might, like, things might turn out different. But in order to be able to know how to actually operate a gun, you have to be taught the right way. And this is what we're trying to do, is teach people how to use guns and have fun, not to injure other people.
For Here and Now, I'm Lauren Rosenthal in Morristown, New York.
And we turn now to Nevada, where last night Scott Dozier would have become the first death row inmate in the U.S. to be executed using the synthetic opioid fentanyl, an execution he very much wanted. He's been on death row for 11 years. But yesterday at the 11th hour, after Alvogen, the maker of the sedative to be used, accused Nevada of illegally securing the drug, a judge blocked Dozier's request to die. Maurice Sharma is a staff writer for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit covering the criminal justice system. He's been speaking with Scott Dozier, including when an execution date was postponed last November. So, Maurice, you probably know how he's feeling now.
The first time that I talked to Scott Dozier, it was after he had discovered that his execution was going to be halted 4 or 5 days ahead of time. So he had sort of ample time to process that, and he was still kind of devastated and dismayed and depressed about it. Not really for himself so much as worrying about the kind of whiplash effect on his family members who have sort of gone through a lot with this. And I'm sure there's some relief for the family members, but for Scott himself, he is very ready for this to be over with.
Well, and perhaps his victims' families will as well. Mm. I mean, horrific deaths, murders that he's accused of, one, of course, that he is on death row for. Just tell us, who is Scott Dozier?
He came from a kind of middle-class upbringing and then made his way into the world of the meth trade, has sort of elements of Breaking Bad, in that he sort of got deeper and deeper into this world and more into a world of violence, and eventually was convicted of two separate very grisly murders of people who are also involved in the drug trade. The case for which he's on death row was the murder of a 22-year-old named Jeremiah Miller. The argument the prosecutors made was that Dozier lured Miller with the promise of money and help with making methamphetamine and getting ingredients to make it, and then murdered him. And Dozier has not admitted to that or any other murder explicitly. He kind of sometimes offers sort of cryptic comments around his role. But a couple of years ago, he decided that rather than continue to appeal this case, you know, on into the future, he wanted to be done with it. He felt that living on death row wasn't really living, and that he didn't want to sort of stare down the rest of his life in solitary confinement. And so he decided to forego his appeals. And the result of this was a kind of scramble by Nevada state officials to put back into motion executions after having not carried one out for more than a decade.
Well, look, we'll talk more about the, you know, mechanics of this, but staying with Scott Dozier, mm-hmm. when you say it had elements of Breaking Bad, it's like a poor man's Breaking Bad, as if Breaking Bad wasn't poor man enough. It just seems so kind of crazy because he's talented. He was an artist. He had a wife and a child, and mm-hmm. they've stuck by him in some ways. I mean, when you spoke to him, did he seem like a monster to you?
No. He is a gregarious and thoughtful and very kind of articulate individual. He loves to talk about a kind of wide variety of subjects. There were times when I was interviewing him where I would just sort of realize that we had drifted away from his case to music or art or some other subject. In his mind, I think he was operating in a world that was outside of the law, and the murders that he committed were in a world of people who sort of know the rules of the game. That's sort of his way of seeing it. And I think that there's a lot of nihilism in that and a sort of amoral view of the world. But I don't think that that necessarily qualifies him as a monster. Mm-hmm. And he certainly doesn't come off that way. I mean, there are, of course, possibly sides to him that I've not seen. I only interacted with this man after he's spent more than a decade on in prison and on many of those years on death row. So he's, you know, come to be this kind of philosophical, calm presence, but that doesn't mean that he's, you know, always been like that. And right. it's hard to know.
Well, and there's no getting around that Jeremiah Miller's body was, you know, beheaded and cut up. I mean, it's just, you know, it is monstrous. But so here you have Scott Dozier giving up his appeal, becoming one in 10 of the 1,400 men and women who've been executed in the last four decades who have abandoned their appeals. You write, the legal community calls them volunteers. Mm-hmm. And you spoke with someone who came up with kind of a profile of who these people are.
The typical profile of one of these individuals actually comports in a big way. This is according to research by John Bloom at Cornell University that sort of comports with the kind of profile of people who commit suicide in the free world. There's elements of mental illness and substance abuse. Racially, it tends to be white prisoners who give up their appeals in disproportionate numbers. And then other scholars have looked at sort of how these prisoners articulate their desires. So some speak of feeling like it was a just sentence that they were given for the crimes that they committed, and they are at peace with it and just want to sort of fade away with that. Dozier is, I think, a little more rare in that, you know, death row in Nevada is not as onerous as it might be in some other states. And also he has a supportive family around him, which is not always true of men on death row. But in other ways, I think Dozier, you know, says things that comport with what a lot of people say who have given up their appeals in death penalty cases. And it's a rare phenomenon, but it's not nearly as rare as I once thought. You know, as I said, 1 in 10 roughly of the people who have been executed have been in this position.
Well, it's also rare to have an execution in Nevada. How did the state have to scramble to meet his requests?
Nevada has had no sort of imminent plans to, you know, have an active execution schedule. And so shortly after Dozier abandoned his appeals, the state Department of Corrections went to drug companies and started soliciting lethal injection drugs. They, I think, solicited something like 247 different potential sources. None of those drug manufacturers or distributors would give them the drugs. So they went back to the drawing board, and then they emerge with a new and never before used combination of drugs to carry out this lethal injection using fentanyl, the opioid that's better known for its, you know, role in a lot of overdose deaths around the country. Finally, a paralytic called sesatricurium. In the past couple of days, the maker of a new drug that was sort of last minute added into the cocktail, a drug called midazolam, the manufacturer of that drug decided to basically go to court and ask the state not to use the drug, arguing that it had been obtained sort of through illegal or improper means.
Yeah. Well, they were going through dry runs and they were asking other states, you know, how do you do this? Mm-hmm. And it's really odd because you talk to researchers who look at states like this who might have conservative district attorneys mm-hmm. who might send a lot of people to death row, but then you might have attorneys general who don't want to risk other voters by carrying out executions. So you've got a lot of people on death row, but not as many executions. I mean, when people are saying, wait a minute, Nevada, you know, is more conservative, they do send people to death row.
Quite a few.
They just don't, they haven't done the executions. And now, you know, people are saying, well, what they're doing with Scott Dozier, or what they were going to do and what they may ramp up to do in the future, is literally state-assisted suicide.
That's right. That's certainly an argument that defense lawyers have made to me. So defense lawyers are an interesting perspective on this because, you know, they're in the business of defending people on death row to try to keep them from being executed. And so when the person on death row says, you know what, I want to be executed, it puts these defense lawyers in a really weird ethical bind where if they continue to represent them and sort of help the prisoners with that request, they are sort of helping them die. And that's led some of those defense lawyers to say, I'm not going to be involved. There was at least one lawyer who abandoned Scott Dozier's case and said, find someone else to do this. I'm not going to help you go into court and ask to be killed. And there's a sense among a lot of these lawyers that it's something like euthanasia, that in a way it's a state-assisted suicide. I think in some ways also lends to the argument that there's a kind of suicidal aspect to this, even if it's not purely suicide in the traditional sense of that word.
Well, and you write that at one point that he'd been sexually abused as a child?
That's right. So in death penalty cases, it's typical for either at the trial stage or during appeals, you know, investigators to go out and learn everything about the background of the person who's facing the death penalty. The idea being that if you know enough about them, that there might be information that would kind of spark mercy among a jury, right? And in Dozier's case specifically, it came out later in the process on appeal that he had been sexually abused as a young person, and personality disorder to him. Nothing on the scale of the kind of like extreme poverty and child abuse that you hear about in some other death penalty cases. You know, Scott Dozier, I think, is really interested in sort of his own sense of agency, his own kind of personhood. And I think he's really dismissive and skeptical of any sorts of sort of accounts of his life that don't put him squarely in control.
You quote him as saying, I'm tired of being someone else's pawn. They've spent millions of dollars giving me a death sentence, then millions of dollars not killing me. He says, it doesn't make any effing sense. You could add, they've also spent millions trying to kill him, trying to set up a system in which to do that. I mean, what do you think happens?
There's this emphasis on this kind of clinical, sterile process of lethal injection, which, you know, existed with little clear legal disturbance for the last 30 plus years. And it was only, you know, a handful of years ago that drug companies really sort of awoke to the use of their drugs in the executions and started putting controls in, spurring the scramble by states to find new drugs. But I think that chaos all speaks to this larger sort of ambivalence around the distance between actually having this punishment and then really actually carrying it out and killing people.
That's Maurice Chama, staff writer for the Marshall Project. They're the nonprofit that covers the U.S. criminal justice system. Maurice, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And the founder of Papa John's, John Schnatter, has resigned as chair of the pizza chain after a Forbes report that he used the N-word during a May conference call. Schnatter issued an apology yesterday that read, "Regardless of the context, I apologize. Simply stated, racism has no place in our society." Papa John's was founded in 1984, has more than 5,000 locations around the world. Joining us now, Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure, available on NPR One. And a quick warning, we're going to be talking about what John Schnatter said, and it could be offensive to many. But Robin, start with what happened. Schnatter made these comments on a conference call, where he was doing media training not to say stupid things.
Yeah, that's the irony. That's the tragicomedy to it. I mean, he was role-playing and playing a bit of devil's advocate, maybe too much, because people both in the room and on the call with the PR agency, the ad agency, took offense. And this training was intended to ameliorate his image after a big PR hit with the NFL's national anthem controversy.
Yeah, he made comments about the NFL players and the National Football League last fall. And it was, now get me on the right track here. Was that why he was having this kind of media training from the agency laundry service?
Yes. I mean, don't be such a bull in a china shop. Your name is on the brand, on the pizza boxes. And he had to leave the C-suite, I think it was about 7 months ago, after criticizing the NFL, which then prompted the league to ditch Papa John's as an official sponsor. And if you think about how much this brand is associated with Sundays and halftimes and Peyton Manning, how much it was about this founder, you know, Papa John, he called himself, and the key man risk of having so much hub and spoke out of one single executive. I think this presents it in sharp relief.
Well, so he said things about – he was critical of the NFL for the kneeling incidents and all of that. And then in this media training incident – and here comes the offensive language. In this media training incident where they were trying to tell him on this conference call, don't say stupid things – he said, but Colonel Sanders, allegedly, according to people who were there, Colonel Sanders called blacks, well, I can't even say, the N-word. What was he trying to say?
Yeah, I mean, he was this role-playing thing is like playing too much of a devil's advocate. Like, these guys are trouncing on me for comments I made in this postmodern era about the NFL and kneeling, and it's not racist. I mean, lynchings happened. People were dragged in trucks. Really graphic language and, you know, a bit too much. He was a bit too much at liberty doing it. And a lot of people are going to come out and say that this is a society gone really too politically correct. Others are saying that you have someone there who just doesn't get the moment, doesn't get a brand this ubiquitous, I think, with what, 3,500 stores in the United States and 1,600 abroad.
Well, he seemed to be trying to say, well, somebody else said something worse, you know, so but it backfired because he ended up saying the thing that people find offensive. As you said, people are going to be split on whether that is, you know, the biggest sin. But meanwhile, how are stocks reacting? What does it mean for the company?
Well, he was already in the doghouse because this is such a laggard brand. It's interesting how the stock today is actually surging 15%, maybe on the idea that Papa John's is going to get a real shot at new management that's no longer obstructed by Schnatter as chairman. I mean, it's been struggling operationally. It's had to discount a lot. The shares were down nearly 14% year to date before this happened.
Yeah. Look, Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure. There's something to be learned here in management teams about even when you are training someone, you have to be careful, you know, of what they may say. Robin Farzad, thank you so much.
Thank you. Look for the Harvard Business School case study. I'm sure it'll happen.
That's right.
Let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Eric J. Lawrence is a DJ with KCRW. He joins us from Santa Monica. Eric, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Jeremy.
And the theme today is your favorite songs of the summer.
Yeah, so we, you know, we've just sort of turned the season here into the summer. So I was picking some of my favorite summer songs through the years, through the decades, that kind of had resonance to me personally, but also serve as kind of nice summery songs.
It's funny, on my Spotify, I have found that there is a new playlist that's called like Summer Flashback or something, and it's all the songs that I was listening to last summer. Interestingly, though, we never hear about fall songs or spring songs, do we? It's always summer songs.
No. Yeah, summer seems to be the time to really sort of sing and celebrate in the musical way.
Okay, well, let's hear some of the music that you brought, starting with the 1961 song School Is Out. This is by Gary U.S. Bonds.
One, two, three.
No more books and studies. Now I can stay out late with my buddies. I can do the things that I want to do. But all my exams are through. I can root for the Yankees from the bleachers.
Doesn't get much more summery than that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. This is actually the most contemporary one for me because just this past year I went back to grad school and getting my master's degree in English literature. And for the first time, and I'm doing this as a guy sort of in his late 40s, so this is the first time in decades that I've had this sort of academic schedule where summer actually really kind of means something special. And so that really made me think about certain songs. There's a common theme of music about songs about school being out, probably the best known as Alice Cooper's School's Out. But this one really spoke to me because, I don't know, it just sort of has that ecstasy to it of the notion of we're finally done with school.
Right.
We've got a couple of months of no responsibility.
And who is Gary U.S. Bonds?
So he was an R&B pop singer that had kind of a heyday in the late 50s, early 60s. He had a number one hit single called Quarter to Three in 1961. School Is Out is actually his follow-up single that reached up to number five on the pop charts. He later was sort of, he had a sort of a short charting career, but was sort of later championed by the likes of Bruce Springsteen, who collaborated with him on a number of records. And just sort of one of those kind of classic rockers from that era.
Okay, the next one you brought us is Peaches. This is from 1977. It's by the Stranglers.
Strolling along, minding my own business. Well, there goes a girl and a half. She's got me going up and down. She's got me going. Girl, that you got some suntan lotion in that bottle of yours. Spread it all over my peeling skin, baby. That feels real good.
With this beat, you can almost hear him strolling down the beach.
Yeah, it's interesting. They're the Stranglers are one of the kind of key UK punk bands, and 1977 was sort of really ground zero for that scene. But they were actually a number of years older than many of their contemporaries. In fact, their original drummer, Jet Black, is older than Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones. So it's an interesting sort of time shift there. But yeah, this song, in fact, it was used in the film Sexy Beast in the year 2000, sort of the opening scene where ex-gangster Ray Winstone is sort of sitting by his pool at his villa in Spain, just sweating and looking all oily and everything. And it just has that sort of kind of lasciviousness to it, for sure.
Okay, next let's listen to the Pointer Sisters. This is from 1984. It's called Automatic.
Your camera looks through me with its x-ray vision, and all systems run aground. All I can manage to push from my lips is a stream of absurdity. Every word I intended to speak winds up locked in.
Definitely in the 80s here. I feel like I'm waiting for Gloria Estefan to pop out of something at this point.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the Pointer Sisters are fascinating to me. I kind of just recently rediscovered them. And going through their discography, they were a group of sisters, legitimately sisters from Oakland, California. Ruth, June, Bonnie, and Anita were the original quartet, and they went through a whole series of different styles. They started off almost as like an Anderson Sisters vocal jazz style. They had a pop phase. They had a classic rock phase where they were covering bands like Bruce Springsteen, Rolling Stone, Steely Dan. But they're probably best known at this point for that classic new wave sound from 1984 that was really ubiquitous. They had a series of huge hit singles that year, and this is another one that won a Grammy from came from their year prior, an album called Breakout. But yeah, they were just one of the biggest bands around at that era.
And what says Summer to you about this song?
That sound, that new wave sound, using sort of that technology, something so fresh from artists that were seasoned and had been, you know, doing these different sort of sounds, they really were able to kind of finesse it to kind of create something really magical. That song has such a weird, distinctive sort of vocal style to it. And I don't know, just as I say, kind of, this is something that I discovered fairly recently. And for me, actually, maybe it's more the summer of just 2 years ago as I was going through their discography. That's sort of what it resonates to me.
Okay, we have one more here. This is called Sloan Ranger. It's a song from this year, 2018, by the Essex Green.
A silver ride. Goodbye, Kensington.
Now, I know from my time in London that Sloan Ranger is a term for basically a yuppie, fashionable person from Sloan Square in London. And you heard him say goodbye Kensington right there. So
yes,
I guess
exactly,
that's what this means in this case, too.
There you go. I had connecting some dots for me.
Right,
I appreciate that.
Right.
Well, it this is an undeniably summery sort of song. The Essex Green have been around since the mid-90s as well. They were a part of the Elephant Six collective of sort of a loose group of indie rock bands. They included groups such as the Apples and Stereo of Montreal, Neutral Milk Hotel, and kind of had a nostalgic, sort of updated, psychedelic sort of sound. And I guess that sort of fits for kind of a swing in London sort of vibe, too, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
So how are you going to be spending your summer, Eric?
Well, in part of it will be in preparation for the new school year, where I'll actually be teaching. So that's going to be a whole new experience for me. But, this is a rare opportunity for me to really kind of sit and enjoy the season. And I think I am really going to enjoy it by kind of going back and picking some of these records that I haven't listened to in quite some time and really just sort of going back and revisiting some old friends.
I guess the lucky thing for you is in LA, the summer never really ends.
That is true. I didn't want to rub it
in. It's okay. That's Eric J. Lawrence, who's a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jerry.
And we've got all of our DJ session picks on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Within a matter of hours, adult film star Stormy Daniels was arrested, made headlines, and then this afternoon saw the charges dropped. Of course, Daniels has been in a huge legal controversy with President Trump over what she says is a 2006 encounter. She's suing Trump and his former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, to void the hush agreement she says she was asked to sign. She was arrested early this morning after she was accused of touching patrons and undercover police officers during a strip club performance in Columbus, Ohio. Okay, we're going to be talking about what happened at that club, and so this conversation is definitely not for all ears. We spoke earlier with Patrick Cooley, a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. It was reportedly her breasts that apparently Daniels was using illegally, so I asked Patrick Cooley, what exactly was she accused of doing?
We pulled charging documents from the municipal court, and according to what is in those charging documents, what she was doing was there were some patrons standing by the side of the stage. She would walk up to one of them, grab his head, put it in her chest, and just shake her breasts around. I believe the pejorative term for that is motorboating. Just to give you a quick rundown of what it says in the complaints. So there were at least four police officers investigating complaints of vice-related violations, and they were watching the performance. They saw this happening. Three of them went up to the stage, and she touched the officers in a similar manner. And so they arrested her and two other employees of this club.
Yeah. Look, you were not there, but presumably from things some of us have seen in films, for instance, what she was doing is what happens at strip clubs. And presumably the patrons themselves were not complaining, but it was when the three officers went to the stage, she could have thought that they were also patrons. But now she's being charged with violating this law and a provision of it called the Community Defense Act, which was proposed by, we understand, a Cincinnati-based conservative religious organization and approved in 2007. What does it say?
It essentially says that stripper is not allowed to touch patrons. There's kind of a weird provision that stakes out an exception if you're related to that person. But essentially, it's designed to keep the strippers from touching the patrons. Enforcement of this law has been kind of spotty. We pulled the court records on it this morning. There have been about 88 arrests since 2007 under the provisions of this law, and about a little bit less than half of them were of the specific subset that Stormy Daniels was charged under, which was the dancer touching one of the patrons.
Well, and I'm glad you cleared that up because there's some misinformation floating around that the law has never been used. But Columbus officials are saying, and you seem to be validating because your paper pulled some records, that they have been using the law. This was part of work that they usually do. But Stormy Daniels' lawyer, we've become familiar with, Michael Avenatti, has been tweeting that this is the same performance she's been doing as part of a nationwide tour and that this was a setup. This was a sting. Here he is speaking earlier today on MSNBC.
It just seems absurd to me that this is something that would require this amount of resources and would result in the arrest of my client. And I also understand that there's other performers that have been arrested in Columbus and then prosecutors decide ultimately not to press charges.
So he's saying that it was a sting directed at Stormy Daniels. They must know who Stormy Daniels is. You know, have you gotten any reporting on that, whether or not this was specifically because it was her?
So that's not what the police are saying. The police are saying they were there because they were getting complaints. In the press release that they sent out, they said that they do enforce this law and they have made other arrests. And the numbers that we pulled this morning do seem to confirm that. They seem to have specifically started to enforce it lately. 25 of the arrests that we pulled came from the first 6 months of this year.
Yeah. Look, Stormy Daniels, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford's lawyer, Avenatti, also said, it's ridiculous that law enforcement resources were used to conduct this. There's got to be a better purpose for such resources. It's early days, but what are people there saying?
So a lot of the feedback we've been getting on social media kind of agrees with that. I saw somebody tweet out that, you know, there's murders in Columbus all the time, and yet the police thought it was worth their time to go to a strip club and...
Four of them.
Yeah, four of them. A lot of the feedback has been kind of a feminist bent. You know, if a woman's willing to do this, why are you charging her for it? So, yeah, a lot of the feedback that we've been getting online, a lot of them seems to agree with Stormy Daniels' lawyer.
That's Patrick Cooley of the Columbus Dispatch there in Columbus, Ohio. Patrick, thank you.
Thank you.
And again, that was our conversation with Patrick from earlier today. Charges against Stormy Daniels have been dropped. Her lawyer, Michael Avenatti, posted a memorandum, and he showed some of the language that he used to argue on her behalf, including arguing that because she was not a regular performer at the club, the law she's accused of violating does not apply to her.
That story started and ended pretty quickly.
It sure did. Motorboating. Okay, Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.